Good afternoon. Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. Members, we will not have a meeting at our regular time tomorrow. No meeting tomorrow. We are not taking up House File 1798 today. That was temporarily laid over yesterday. We'll be taking that up next week sometime. Next week, we will probably first meet on Tuesday. So watch your calendars. We will probably be having a meeting on Tuesday. With that, members, let's go to our agenda today. There are no other questions. Representative Swenson moves that House File 2442 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Swenson, would you, I know you've got an amendment too. Would you like us to take that amendment first? I think it's pretty much a technical amendment.
But, Mr. Chairman, that would be fine.
Okay, Representative Swenson moves the A1 amendment, which is a technical amendment. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Swenson, or your witness, can you tell us about the bill?
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. And House File 2442, it makes the current CNS law consistent with amendments that we've been made to the Universal Farm Commercial Code and related farm product lien statutes over the past 3 years. It also conforms our law to changes made at the federal level in 2002. Mr. Chairman, I have with me Mr. John Apitz, who brought this bill to me, and Mr. Apitz, would you care to say a few words? I know you probably don't want lengthy testimony, but I would let him explain a little bit of it.
Sure. Mr. Apitz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that was my cue from the author. Very briefly, this is essentially some work that completes about 5 years of effort. The State Bar Association and others who are involved in commercial lending are putting together. This involves the CNS, the Central Notification System for Farm Product Liens, and what it is essentially is a method that uses the central computer system at the Secretary of State's office to give notice to buyers of farm products that a lender has a lien in place. It is a voluntary system used by lenders to notify buyers. It comes out of, it's about 12 years old. We've been working with it for that period of time. Buyers, lenders, and all those who are affected by it have grown quite used to it and find it to be of great value and great use. The amendments that we're making here, as the author said, bring it up to snuff with changes that were made to the Uniform Commercial Code about 3 years ago and some other farm lien statutes that were changed 2 years ago. The amendment that you looked at, there's a physical note with this, and that's why you're seeing it, of about $60,000 to reprogram the Secretary of State's computers, and that will be paid for through a surcharge on these filings that are made by lenders at the time of filing. $10 surcharge that'll take about 1 year, that'll last for 1 year, and after that we'll go away. So that'll raise about the $60,000 that's appropriated in the amendment that you just adopted.
Any discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing no discussion. All in favor of House File 2442 as amended, being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next up, a slight change in the agenda. We'll take House File 2101, and then after that, we'll take House File 2905. Representative Seifert moves that House File 2101 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Thank Representative you, Seifert, I know you've got a couple of amendments. Do you want to take the amendments or discuss the bill first?
Mr. Chair, I think to make the bill work, I should have the amendments go on so we can discuss what the situation is with the bill.
All right. I think maybe the A2 amendment first, right. I think, is a technical amendment.
Right. Mr. Chairman, the local government impact note request on Section 1 would be paid for by fees that I've talked to the city association and whatnot that has been agreed upon with the Department of Finance on page 2. But there needs to be an appropriation made first, and then the fee pays it back. And council that drafted this, they said that makes the bill work.
Representative Seifert moves the A2 amendment. Discussion to the A2 amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I have the A4 amendment. I'll move that, and it's being passed out. I do have a slight variation I need to make to it that I'll incorporate. I just want to make sure all the members have it first. Does everyone have it?
No.
Yeah, it's just being passed out right now. Why don't you start talking about the amendment first?
Mr. Chairman, let's make some changes to it. The incorporated change I'd like to make would be lines 14 through 16. And it would be after the word determines, you'd insert the word to. And I don't know who does the... Does Ms. Novak keep track of this for the record? Okay, Ms. Kodrick. On line 14, you'd add the word to after the words determine. Strike the word that. Strike the word of. And before the word implementation, add the word the. On line 16, you'd put a period after approval and strike the rest of the sentence that would say would result immediate threat to public safety or health.
Okay, well, Representative Seifert, why don't you read what lines 14 through 16 would then say?
Members, on page 1, line 14, where it's under E, subdivision 3 does not apply if the governor determines to delay the implementation of a rule pending legislative approval. And I can explain what that means, actually, if members want me to go through what this means. Basically, in the bill, I think Representative Solberg's on GovOps with me. I don't know if anyone else here is, but this is the rule reform bill. It's a variation of what last year I think we passed it 113-19. The governor vetoed it because they felt that it moved too much authority to the legislative branch in terms of objecting to rulemaking. And so what we did is try to come up with a compromise and working with objecting parties and so forth. And what this does is, I'll tell members how the bill changed from last year so they have an idea. Last year, basically what we did is we set up a state agency came up with proposed rules that affect any entity whatsoever to the tune of $10,000 in any given year. That the legislature would then have to approve those rules. And they felt that gave the legislature too much power. So they vetoed the bill. What we did this year is we scoped it down to, if members take a look at the actual bill, section 2 would be, let's see, it's just now for small businesses. It's basically on page 2 of the bill, lines 19 through 25. Legislative approval would be required if agency rules impact a small business, and that would be defined as 50 or fewer full-time employees, to the tune of $50,000 or greater, which is a pretty high threshold. So it does not affect, schools and things like that. I know some people were saying it should include all those things. But what this amendment does is it brings in cities. If you look at the amendment on lines 8 through 10, I had some requests for that. And then on lines 14 through 23, what we're doing is allowing a waiver process where the governor could determine that it would need to be waived for some particularly good reason and inform the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate as to why that waiver needs to be granted. And the National Federation of Independent Business is very much in favor of this bill. As members know, we oftentimes will get agency rules and regulations thrown on the backs of our small business people. We'll come around door knocking and they'll say, "Where did this come from, this expensive mandate?" And we'll say, "Well, I don't know where it came from." We'll have a research staff look it up, and it was an agency rule. And what this is saying is for the very expensive rules, those that are $50,000 or greater, if you have a small business of 50 or fewer employees, that portion of the rules has to go to the legislature for approval. So if they have 500 pages of rules and 2 pages of it require some expensive mandate, those 2 pages will go to the legislature for approval, and the other 498 pages of explanations and terminology and so forth will go into rule. And that's another change from last year, members. Last year, the whole entire rule docket would have been sent to the legislature. Now it's just the portion of the rules that impact the businesses on a fiscal level. And the governor is allowed to waive this, so we're giving, you know, the power back to the governor. If the agency can determine that there's a good reason for not sending it to the legislature, the ball is in the governor's court. But remember, I want this to be in with people who hold election certificates are accountable, not bureaucrats. And so I'm trying to keep the authority with people who have election certificates.
Representative Seifert, I want to make sure I understand that change you made to the amendment on lines 14 through 17. I mean, subdivision 3 talks about legislative approval being required, and your new language basically says that this doesn't apply if the governor wants to delay implementation of a rule pending legislative approval. Is that what you mean, or should that subdivision 3 be maybe section 3?
Mr. Shepard told me that it probably worked better if we added the word not after the word determines, not to delay the implementation. What I'm basically looking for is the governor has the ability to waive legislative approval if he determines it to be necessary. Mr. Shepard said it should say not after the word determines.
Determines not to. All right. Okay, that...
Because if it's under sub E, that's effective for section 2, correct? Right.
Okay, so now...
Yep.
Page 1, lines 14 through 16 would read, subdivision 3 does not apply if the governor determines not to delay the implementation of a rule pending legislative approval. So,
why if the governor determines not to,
it means he's moving forward without...
We're trying to get a positive out of 2 negatives, and I guess this is what we want, but I don't know if there's a cleaner...
There might be a better way.
A cleaner way to do that. I don't want to put the word ain't in there, but I'm trying to find a way to...
Neither do I, Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, if positives, you've got 2 negatives.
We may have to call on the English teachers in the delegation here to help out Representative Seifert. I don't know. Representative Seifert, is the idea here to say that if the governor doesn't want to comply with this law that he can waive it?
That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, I was just going to say the governor may waive the requirements of Section 2. Is what? Could I just say that? Mr. Shepard said we could say the governor may waive. Okay, Mr. Shepard says that it's written better with the 2 nots in it for some reason.
All right. Well, I think I understand it with the... with the 2 knots in it. I guess I just wanted to make sure that was what you wanted to do. Okay, so Representative Seifert moves the A4 amendment with that incorporation that I have read. Does everyone understand that? Are there any questions or discussion to the A4 amendment? Seeing no discussion. All in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Seifert, to the bill as amended.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, I'll just walk through the bill. I know we covered some of it. Section 1 was the one that was non-controversial last year. It allows basically any local unit of government under the sun to request a local fiscal impact and fiscal benefit note as proposed by a state agency. We have a lot of local units of government who say that we're throwing mandates at them, but they have no way of determining how agency rules are affecting them. And Department of Finance can do a local impact note, but as you see on page 2, line 7, the local unit of government will then have to step up to the plate and pay for the local impact note. And that's on a voluntary basis. So if they want to determine how much a mandate may cost, that an agency is going to throw at them, they certainly can step up to the plate and request this. And the cities, counties, et cetera, all very much in favor of this, the coalition of greater Minnesota cities and all that. And then Section 2, as I explained before, with the amendment, we scoped it down to just small businesses of less than 50 employees, where a proposed agency rule would exceed $50,000. Mr. Hickey and I have worked together on this, and we're trying to limit it just for the really bad situations where there may be a really expensive unfunded mandate. And then we gave the governor the right to waive that section. And the effective date for Section 1 is 2004, and the effective date for the next section is actually 2005. Mm-hmm. So if we have any concerns, we can clean them up if need be. But
Mr. Chair? Speaker Swigum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, I really liked your bill of last year. And 10 years ago, I really liked the bills that we had coming forward that said every agency rule is temporary until the legislature meets the next time this year, and we had to give our approval, our ratification to every rule to make sure the legislative intent was met. But saying that, as you brought forward House File 2101 today, who can be against the bill as you're bringing it forward today? What would be a reason for being against it? Who would be against it? I can't imagine anybody being against it, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, after working through all the bugs and increasing the threshold and making the waiver in there, I've been more than accommodating. And I know at the time when we brought through all those initiatives, the majority leader was very supportive, but now the governor is not. So it's very interesting to try to reconcile those two issues. It's not a partisan thing. I think it's a branch of government issue, because I honestly had a lot of DFL support for this. And it's one. I am not in any way. When I go back and hear complaints from my small business owners, we can't blame the Democrats. They haven't had the governor's office since 1990. So, folks, it's the agencies making the rules. There needs to be some accountability now on a bipartisan level.
Representative Solberg.
Just a point of clarification. If an agency is already in the middle of making a rule, does this apply, or does it the kickoff start after it's in effect when they start a rule? So, my question is, if an agency, sometimes a rulemaking is 6 months long, and it should be if it's controversial, then if they are in the process, does this kick in, or does it kick in after the effective date for rules that started at that particular time?
I think, Representative Solberg, if you look at Section 4 on page 4, it explains that these sections apply to any rule for which the hearing record has not closed before that date, or if there is no public hearing for which the agency has not submitted the record to the administrative law judge before that date. Representative Seifert, I guess I would interpret that as saying that if a rule hasn't been issued by August 1st, this bill applies to it. Is that correct, Representative Seifert?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shepard said that would be read literally in Section 4, and so that's what, because we do have to have, at some point, a closing time for the record to start and to end. That's a great question.
Okay. Representative Kelleher?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seifert, I wanted to ask you about I think doing this the way you're doing it in terms of the local units having to pay the cost makes sense. I'm curious if there's been an estimation of how many of these may come forward, because I don't serve on these committees, so I'm not quite sure. I haven't heard the discussion previous to this about how many rules that folks may find objectionable. Do you have an idea of an estimate of how many?
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, I know of only, there was an instance, Representative Knobloch had a bill where the agencies were opposed to some rulemaking reform that was used one time, I think, now in 6 years. And I've heard there are probably one or two instances where they may have some concerns on rules that come forward, and it's tough to predict because we don't know exactly what rules are going to come out in the next couple of years that are on the docket, but I don't expect that it will be used very often, and they've told me that it would probably be used about as much as when Representative Knobloch's bill was brought up about 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, Representative Keller, I had a bill about 6 years ago, I think it started, that allowed local units of government to appeal a rule if there was some sort of new technical information that came out on a rule that showed that it was wrong or needed to be revised. And I had, a 40-page fiscal note or something on it talking about how much it was going to cost with all these rules that would be appealed, and I think I've had one actual appeal since the bill passed about 4 years ago. So it is hard to predict. I think agencies gave it their best prediction back when they were putting the fiscal note together, but there haven't been as many appeals by far as they thought.
And if I could just ask one more question,
sure,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, I'm just curious, with the amendment we did for the governor's office in terms of not specifying that it had to be waived in terms of health and safety and those sorts of issues, mm-hmm. I mean, are we worried, are you worried that this is going to be overused by the governor's office then in terms of the exception?
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, that's a good question. I guess I want to work with our friends across the street, and I don't want to just say health and safety if there's environmental concerns or if there's a concern about transportation or education or whatever. I think it's better to leave it broad-based, and if there is a problem that we see, I'm certainly willing to come back and say, hey, the governor's office is abusing this. But remember, right now it's with the agency-level determination where you have the career bureaucrats and unaccountable folks and appointed commissioners and whatnot. This would actually make someone with an election certificate to say, okay, I'm going to step forward and give a waiver to this very expensive mandate. Because remember, it's $50,000 of impact on a business of 50 or fewer employees. We took out all the other stuff. So it has to be a pretty massive or expensive mandate to warrant that type of action. So I don't see it even actually triggering very often. We asked Mr. Hickey to try to come up with some examples where it may have come up, and he's going to come up with those hopefully by the time it hits the House floor.
Well,
but hopefully this isn't a common thing, because I don't think anyone around the table wants a small business to get sacked with, you know, $100,000 of unfunded mandates from some type of agency. So it's just really kind of a really generous safeguard.
Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to think of this as applied, because sometimes, and the worry I have here is the benefit to one local district, or the impact in one district will have an adverse impact in another local unit of government. So, Representative Knobloch, I was thinking about your district, and I was thinking about there's somebody putting something in the Mississippi River in Garrison above your water intake. And it's not an immediate threat to public safety because it's a carcinogen, and you don't only have to worry about those ones every 72 years or something. The township says, geez, we don't want this rule to go into effect, so we're going to challenge it. And the city of St. Cloud is going, uh-oh, we're going to have to pay more to clean up our drinking water because this stuff, whatever it is getting in the drinking water. So I have some worries here about drinking water. And because we use the word immediate threat rather than just threat to public safety or health.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, I just talked to Mr. Shepard because I know that was an issue you brought up on last year's bill when we brought it, which was probably more heavy-handed and so forth. For Section 1 on line 13, members can draw their attention where it asks for a local fiscal impact and fiscal benefit note. So if there is someone that gains or loses, we can have that information brought forward. But Mr. Shepard said for the second section that we do not incorporate that. And I don't know if there would be a way we could try to bring that in the mix for Section 2. It's a little complicated, but at least for Section 1, we do address that point. That there are benefits to rules or we wouldn't do them, I think is what you're saying.
Well, no, there may be rules that have no benefit, and I can agree with that, but I think you do want to be cautious when you're doing rules, but sometimes a township, say I'm using Representative Knobloch's district, Garrison Township is above his drinking water intake, and there's somebody who's putting something in the water that PCM makes a rule or health makes a rule and says, nah, you got to not put that in the Mississippi because it shouldn't get into the drinking water. Well, St. Cloud maybe could go to a reverse osmosis system and keep it out of the water, but that's a very expensive proposition, perhaps. Or they just leave it in because it's too expensive. So I think we have to look at that tension between jurisdictions, which I hope you can work on subdivision 2 or section 2. And I also think the word immediate in your threat to public safety or health is a word that you should really take out.
Well, Representative Wagenius, though, as I understand it, I mean, section 1 pretty much deals with the request for the note, and so presumably St. Cloud would come forward and say, well, this may be beneficial to Garrison, but it's not beneficial to us, and so that would be weighed. The section Representative Seifert is talking about only relates to a business and not to a city, so I think that, you know, you'd have to be talking about a business maybe then. Representative Seifert, am I wrong about that?
Yeah, actually you are, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And Representative Wagenius, on page 1 with the amendment we adopted, we crossed out would result in immediate threat to public safety and health, so it's a broad-based waiver now. For any reason, okay, he can waive the requirements. So if there is an environmental concern, a commerce concern, federal laws that come in, there's exemptions for. If we fund mandates, and that's all in the bill, if we have a funded mandate, this does not apply. It's for unfunded agency rule mandates on small businesses. And then, Mr. Chairman, if you notice in lines 8 through 10, we included cities that are small, less than 50 employees.
Okay, but if it's a situation where there's an immediate threat, then you have the waiver available. If it's not an immediate threat, then you wait till the legislative session to decide what to do. And presumably, if it's not an immediate threat, it can wait for the legislature to decide what we're going to do. Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that would be the intent, is if there is something that's controversial during session, we can deal with it. And if it's out of session, and if it's that type of a situation where we've got a business that has 20 employees and we're mandating, or an agency is mandating something that's 50,000 or more, that's a pretty big slap across the face for a small business, and that's why a lot of people said, gee, that's an awfully generous threshold that you have. I guess I just want to get something started and see if it even gets into the, you know, gets into being used. Last year's threshold, as you remember, was $10,000, and the agencies went bananas and called the governor, and the governor called me, even though I went through 5 committees and never heard anybody say anything, you know, and then it got vetoed. So I guess if things get really bad, we could bring the bill back from last year, but because it is sitting at the desk. But I'd like to try to do this one and work with people a little bit.
Other discussion? Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to the immediate threat, you struck the language for the immediate threat in your amendment, correct?
Yes. So now it's just a broad-based waiver.
So where are you talking about that if there is immediate threat? You just had a discussion with Representative Wagenius about, well, if there is not an immediate threat, then you can go through waiting till the legislature comes back in session. There's no language in here.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Segrin, basically what I'm saying is the governor has, instead of saying he can waive the requirements of Section 2 only if there's an immediate threat, now he can waive it for any reason, mm-hmm, including immediate threats. That's what we're saying.
All right.
Am I right, Mr. Shepard, on that?
Representative Segrin.
Just another question. On line 21 of your bill, does the Commissioner of Finance have to prepare both a fiscal impact and fiscal benefit, or one or the other?
I'll defer to Mr. Shepard. I think we had that conversation in GovOps, but I don't remember. There would be one note, and it would be mixed together, benefit if there is any, and impact negative if there is any. And they would be given an estimate of the bill beforehand so they knew how much it would potentially cost them. Because the finance department has an idea of how many hours. Because when we submit bills right now, they do notes for this committee, for example, so they have an idea of what it costs. Mm-hmm. So they will have to foot the bill for that, and they will be cognizant of that.
Representative Seagren.
Just one other question. On your section 2, where an agency has to determine the initial or yearly cost of complying with the proposed rule, if it exceeds $50,000 for any one business, how will an agency know if a rule would have that kind of an impact for any one business?
Mr. Chairman, the agency goes through kind of a laborious situation of what we call a SONAR, a statement of need and reasonableness, mm-hmm. and they bring in all the invited parties, impacted parties, stakeholder groups, et cetera, and generally have an idea of what the impact will be if they go through the SONAR process and people are invited in for testimony and so on and so forth. And there has to be a good faith effort at this, and we talked about that in GovOps, that it's got to be a two-way street. And Mr. Hickey and the organizations know that if there's something coming down the pike, that they're supposed to be active and engaged in this, since they're the ones that are very interested in this provision.
Representative Seagren.
One more follow-up. So right now, in current law, we have the ability to request a local impact note for if a chair or a lead minority member or the Ways and Means can request a local impact note for any possible bill.
Yes.
Now you're talking about rule, and but this only would apply to local government. We can't. Does the legislature have the ability to request a local impact note for any kind of a rule?
Mr. Chair, Representative Seagren, I believe, Mr. Shepard, that was it one of the reform bills I carried about 6 years ago or something, allows Ways and Means or tax chair or ranking minority member to request it?
That's for a bill.
For a local. No, that's also for, I think it's also for rules, too. Mr. Shepard, are you familiar with that issue?
Representative Seifert, I think it's just the tax committee chair in the House.
We'll have Mr. Shepard come forward. I believe it was the tax chair, at least. We'll find out. The governor or the chair of a standing committee to which a bill delegating rulemaking authority has been referred may require an agency to which the rulemaking authority is granted under a bill to prepare a rulemaking note on the proposed delegation of authority. Blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's the one. Here's one. Local impact notes. The Commissioner of Finance will coordinate with the development of a local impact note for any proposed legislation introduced after June 30th, 1997. Actually, that wasn't me. That was someone else because I just got here in 97. Or any rule proposed after December 31st, 99 upon request of the chair or ranking minority member of either legislative tax committee. Upon receipt of a request to prepare a local impact note, the Commissioner must notify the authors of the legislation. And it sets up a big lugubrious process for that. So the tax committee chair can request a local impact note on rules, I think is the short answer.
All right. Any other discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of House File 2101 as amended, being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2101 as amended is passed. Next we have House File 2905. Chair will move that House File 2905 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules. I don't know that this met the original committee deadline, so we need to send it to Rules. Welcome to the committee, Representative Broad. Can you tell us about House File 2905?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2905 essentially gives us an opportunity for efficiency, also gives shows us an example of intra and intergovernmental cooperation, and allows us to give the best bang for the taxpayers' dollar through the Department of Administration's procurement rules. So I wanted to touch base on the fiscal note. This bill has come through both government operations and state government finance. And state government finance did have a fiscal note attached to it. We did make some amendments working with Representative Kahn, and in that case, the bill before you does not have a fiscal note attached to it.
Discussion to House File 2905. Representative Rukavina.
Chair, Representative Broad, why do you exclude, if I'm reading that right, the Department of Corrections industries from being able to take advantage of it? Or am I reading that backwards?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, we worked with the department. Their concern was that we were crisscrossing over what Marine Corps is doing, and we certainly don't want to be taking anything away from what Marine Corps is doing. That's the reason for that exclusion.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Marine Corps, I don't even know a certain acronym.
Marine Corps is actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. Marine Corps is what the prisoners are actually doing in terms of the products that they're developing. You may have a state seal or see a state seal on throughout the Capitol, and they may have done that for you. But they're providing a variety of different services and products.
Furniture. Tables.
Any other discussion to House File 2905? Seeing no further discussion. All in favor of House File 2905 being recommended to pass and refer to the Rules Committee, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Broad. And members, if anyone does want to give testimony on any of these bills, I invite you to talk to our page, Eric Anderson, or send a note up front here. Just want to make sure people know they have that opportunity.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Is Representative... Oh, here's Representative Davids. You got here just in time, Representative Davids. Yeah. We're just going to give it to someone else. Welcome to the committee, Representative Davids. Chair will move that House File 2640 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. And Representative Davids, I see one amendment, the A4 amendment, which I believe is a technical amendment. Do you want me to move that amendment now, Representative Davids?
Okay, I've got a A3 amendment.
Oh, okay.
Is there an A4?
I got an A4 and I don't have an A3.
Yeah, A4 is a technical amendment that staff prepared, Representative Davids.
Okay.
And maybe we can take that first. I'll move the A4 amendment. This is just a technical amendment to make sure the money flows right. Any discussion to the A4 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. There's another amendment, Representative Davids.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's an A3 amendment that can be passed out.
Okay, let's pass out the A3 amendment. It is in people's packets, I'm told.
I do not have it.
I do not.
All right, I didn't have it before either. Let's see. We've got some up here. We'll pass it out right now. Representative Davids, I'll move the A3 amendment. Why don't you tell us about the A3 amendment while we're passing it out?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I will defer to Mr. Deputy Commissioner Nelson from the Department of Commerce.
Commissioner Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Patrick Nelson. I'm a Deputy Commissioner of Commerce. This, I think, is also might be considered a technical amendment. It was a catch by the Department of Labor and Industry. It just adds the Department of Commerce to the data practices statutes to allow us to interchange information regarding fraud. Their fraud investigators currently have this ability, and as part of this law, they're moving over to be part of the fraud unit. So industrial commerce needed to be mentioned in the same statutes as labor and industry was.
All right. I want to make sure everyone has a chance to see the amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? See no discussion. Everyone in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. All right, Representative Davids, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 2640 is the insurance fraud bill. Several years ago, I think finally last year, we passed the insurance fraud division, but it was not funded. And so what we're doing this year is we're funding it. The bill also takes the auto theft prevention program that's been in law for some years from the Department of Public Safety and puts it over to the Department of Commerce. So we're not taking any of those funds that I think is a 50-cent surcharge on your auto insurance bill. That currently funds the auto theft bill. We're not changing that. We're only moving it from the Department of Public Safety over to the Department of Commerce. And then we're taking existing language for the insurance fraud division, and we're actually funding it. And the way we fund it is on the bill on page 4, you can see the funding mechanism. It's being funded by the insurance companies themselves. They feel very strongly that they need this mechanism in the Department of Commerce, or this insurance fraud unit in the Department of Commerce, to go after some of the folks that are, well, have been defrauding insurance companies. You can see that if they have less than $100 million in assets, they're assessed only $200. Minnesota written premium of under $10 million, they're assessed $200, so it'll be a total of $400. And you can go right down the list, and that funds the new program. So a very simple bill. The language is already in law. All we're doing is funding it and removing auto theft from Department of Public Safety over to Department of Commerce.
Discussion of the bill. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, you're not getting the actual funding for this is coming from where? General funders are out of that auto theft program. That money's been stolen so many times. It's happening again.
No.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, we're not stealing the money this time. We'll probably do that another day. But in this bill, what we're trying to do is actually save that program, leave the money there from the 50 cents that's on your auto insurance policy. We don't touch that. We're just moving that over to Commerce, where I feel it's a better fit, and others feel that way too. There are still some discussions going on as we speak between some of the police unions. They're still not totally sold on the idea. We're still working with them on moving it for public safety. They kind of like public safety. We say it's auto insurance, auto theft. We've got the fraud unit. Let's move them all over to Commerce. So that's still an issue. But the money for the insurance fraud unit to fund that comes directly from the insurance company, separate from that fee that's on your auto insurance bill. We're leaving that alone.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Kind of like what Representative Bradley talks about all the time, when you put mandates on insurances and then the consumer pays for it, so the consumer is going to be paying for this program. Because the insurance companies are just going to mark up their premiums to pay for it. Am I correct? You're a better capitalist than me.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, that would have that effect because they're going to be paying out of their reserves and out of their funds, and so, of course, they would pass that on to the consumer.
And, Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Rukavina.
Given my, progressive libertarian tendencies, Representative Davids, give me an example of exactly what you see happening here as far as helping the consumer and how the peace officers and it's all going to work.
Representative Davids.
Okay, talk about your libertarian tendencies. I want to be clear that I'm a moderately liberal conservative. And so I just want to make sure that's clear. The way I see this working is what they'll have is they'll have actual police officers certified by the Post Board. They'll be the employees of this unit. They will go out and investigate when there's complaints that come in that there's been insurance fraud, there's been cars stolen or sent to chop shops or whatever the case might be, or in the past there have been rings of, and this very rarely happens, of course, because most chiropractors and doctors are unscrupulous, or are scrupulous, but there are some unscrupulous ones. Where's Abler? I hope you can hear that. I said that wrong. They're very upfront and honest and forthwith people. But there are a couple bad ones, and if they could get in insurance fraud as far as marking up doctor claims, white sheeting life insurance policies, a lot of different things you can do to rip off insurance companies. And they want to put a stop to it. And the net effect, hopefully, will be with the few dollars that are spent to do this, if we can, I think we'll stop many, many times over that in insurance fraud, and it should actually save consumers money because they should be paying out less. Well, they won't hopefully be paying out on so many fraudulent claims.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
For maybe one more, and I know.
One more, Representative Rukavina.
Yes, sir. So, Representative Davids, Mr. Chair, members. So I have, let's see, this is a real example. Couple of constituents will go away on vacation and their brother's checking on their house in Virginia, and we have steam heat, you know, through our publicly owned utility, and the brother comes there and the house is totally flooded because the pipe, one of the pipes in the wall was 35 below on one of our warmer days up there, and it floods the house. So the insurance companies, and even and the insurance policy they have, that if anything happens to their house, as some, such as this flooding and other things, that they get a hotel room while it's being fixed. So the insurance company puts one of those big dryer fan type things in one room and says the house is fixed, you can live in it. You know, which I called up the insurance go-between, and he said, hey, I can't do anything, I got a boss telling me this and blah, blah, blah. With that type of, would a consumer actually be able to get protection from an unscrupulous insurance company under this proposal? Would they be investigated? Would the police officer that you're going to be hiring now for insurance not just go after individual consumers and customers of insurance policies that may be fraudulent or doing things like you mentioned, but will they go after an insurance company that obviously is being fraudulent towards its customers?
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, that's a good question. This bill would not work in that manner, but I think we already have a mechanism in place to take care of that, and that's calling the Commerce Department themselves that can already make sure that the insurance company treats the customer fairly.
Well, I tried that, Mr. Chair, so I won't even tell you, given the past week events, but how I handled this one, and I was so made out okay.
All right, Representative Rukavina. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, first of all, the title of the group is called Insurance Fraud Prevention, and yet it looks like everything's about investigation, arrest, that kind of thing. What's the notion of prevention in this?
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bradley, I'm going to turn that over to Deputy Commissioner Nelson to give his view on that.
I could look
Commissioner
back.
Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative. I believe the title comes from the notion that this is an economic crime that's not currently enforced to a great degree, and if the unit works as envisioned, there would be a deterrent effect on persons attempting fraud, in effect, hopefully preventing some of it.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it sounds better. The other question I have is, the way you're recouping the expenses is by charging. Is there any ability to have civil penalties whereby perhaps this could self-pay by the actual collection of civil penalties?
Representative Davids or Mr. Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bradley, I believe that the penalties would go into the general fund, and it's funded by the assessment on the insurance companies, but I would also defer to get that clarified from Mr. Nelson here.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. There aren't any civil penalties here, but the fraud unit has the ability to refer for criminal prosecution. There is civil fraud penalties the other way, where if the insurance company is acting toward its consumers, as Representative Rukavina had indicated, we have the ability to get fines and penalties that way. This would result in, they would go to the general fund, yes.
Representative Solberg.
A couple of questions. On page 4, your assessment, does that apply to my local insurance agent as opposed to the insurance company?
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, that would be the company itself, not the agent. Or the agency, it would be the company.
Okay. And then the second thing, is there anything in this that would allow the Department of Commerce to have administrative penalties imposed without having the ability to go to the court of law? I mean, I'm not one that's in favor of administrative penalties. I'm in favor of civil penalties that have chance to go to the court, but is there administrative penalties imposed?
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, this, in talking to Deputy Commissioner Nelson, this would go through the court system. It would go to the courts.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
Point of clarification. The Department of Commerce, and under this provision, has no authority to level a civil penalty against somebody that they accuse of defrauding the insurance company.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. I'm not aware that we have civil fining authority under this statute. And if I'm wrong, I'll get back to you. But I'm pretty sure that we don't. We have it in our other statutes, but that goes through the administrative procedures, which then are appealable to the court system. So I believe this is criminal, goes to the courts. Our other powers are administrative and then can get to the courts.
Thank you.
Other discussion to the bill as amended, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this A3 amendment, it took me a while to digest it, but what kind of information are you planning on getting from individuals, employers? Why did you modify just that section having to do with data from employers?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my understanding is this amendment came from the Department of Labor and Industry. Their current fraud unit investigators use this authority or need this authority, and they are moving over to Commerce as a result of earlier legislation. Actually, it's scheduled to happen in July of this year. So for them to continue doing the job they're currently doing, Commerce needed to be added to this section. What exactly they get in terms of how they do their investigations, I'm not 100%. And if somebody here from the Department of Labor is here, maybe they can explain it.
So
Representative Holberg.
If just for clarification purposes, so this isn't directly related to the new group that's being set up, but rather this is to take care of a different kind of transfer? Or, I mean, number one, I'm not understanding why you're only modifying information on employers. If you're doing insurance fraud, I'm sure that the range of investigation is going to go far beyond where somebody's employed and whether they were at work or not on a particular day, et cetera.
Mr. Chair,
Nelson.
Representative, as part of earlier legislation, the Workers' Compensation Fraud Investigative Unit is going to come to Commerce. So they are currently doing workers' comp fraud, and then by law they are going to be limited to workers' comp fraud, but they are going to be part of this unit. So they are coming over, and they need the same authority essentially that they have now, because their job isn't going to change. The building of where they report to work is, but in effect their job isn't going to change. So they needed to put Department of Commerce in there. That's why they need information from employers.
All right, and that could take up a lot of the committee's time.
We hope
but
not.
I think that there should be some concern at this table that we're going to give Department of Commerce access to employee records. I'm not so sure we want to do this unless it's in a very limited and constrained manner as opposed to the whole department having access to the degree they want it of personal employee records. And so I'm a little concerned about this amendment.
Well, I think there's someone from the department here that maybe can give us some more enlightenment on this. Can we have the person from, I believe it's Commerce, step forward? Or Labor and Industry, rather.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask if she's coming down another concern? And that is, it doesn't seem to be very narrowly drafted to that particular part, but it looks like the whole Department of Commerce has that authority. And I want to know if it's narrowly drafted to just that particular problem.
All right.
Anybody.
All right. We have a representative of the Department of Labor and Industry here, I believe. Can you give us your name and give us your testimony?
Jamie Anderson, Department of Labor and Industry. You're right, it is not narrowly drafted, and I don't know if this committee wants to narrow that. That would be fine, but Deputy Commissioner Nelson was exactly right in the fact that the people who are currently labor and industry employees will be doing the same job at Commerce, and they were concerned that they would not be able to do their job to the fullest extent without access to the information that they have now. As far as your concerns go, it's not narrowly tailored to our department now, although I don't access the information. So it is only used by those fraud investigators, and so that's why I guess it was written for ease.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, I think when you look at the, you know, what has to be done in an investigation, there has to be data given to the investigator in order to investigate the case, figure out if it's got the legal basis to take it to court. But then in court, they have to have all the facts and information in order to present their case. And if they have constraints on what they can collect in data on this employee or this person who's committed the fraud, they could lose the case, and then it just goes on. So I think you're right. I think we need to narrow the scope, you know, or the who has access to this information and treat it that way. But we still have to give that investigator the latitude to investigate this thoroughly, so when he goes to court and the prosecutor presents the case, that they got a solid case. Otherwise, it gets thrown out on technicalities, and we can't afford to do that either, because then we might as well not even have the bill then.
Representative Holbert, to that point.
Well, to that point, and that's the other part of this problem, is that they've only amended the section of law that relates to employee records. So, I mean, if they're saying that the only kind of insurance fraud they're going to be investigating relates to a person and their employment, and that's the only place they want access to data, then they've done that here. If they want access to other information held, then beyond just employees, I mean, I'm assuming that there's more to insurance fraud investigation than just what you've done at work.
Maybe.
So, I mean, I don't think this does what they want, and I think there are unintended consequences in what's in the language. And, I mean, they can either take it back out or work on it before it gets to the floor or whatever, but we're not going to solve it here in a committee of 25 people.
Representative Haas and Fulberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think if Representative Fulberg, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. There's enough people in this room that has heard the discussion that have a stake in this bill, and maybe by the time we get to the floor, we can have a better fix for it. And I think that would be the best way. We should move this bill along, though.
Ms. Novak, you have a suggestion?
Mr. Chairman and members, my understanding is that this, the A3 amendment is not directly related to the insurance fraud parts of the bill, but to the investigation of workers' compensation fraud. And it was just amended to the bill because it deals with the same department.
All right. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I have a little recollection of this because I believe I established that fraud investigation unit because, you know, when we were having the big worker comp debates back in the early and mid-90s, one of the charges was, you know, that people were frauding the system, and we wrote the legislation so that everybody was investigated, just like I asked Representative Davids, whether the insurance companies were investigated, and we were told, of course, yes, that's what they want. This was, you know, during the Carlson administration, and I recall asking Labor and Industry many times, who's been investigated. It was always injured workers who were being investigated, not all the other parts of the system that we intended. Now I'm surprised to see that this has come full circle, and I am puzzled as to why. Investigators from Labor and Industry who are dealing with workers' comp issues would be reporting to the Commissioner of Commerce when I remember what the intent of that legislation was. And it was not to just investigate, it's not just about insurance fraud, it's about insurance companies frauding injured workers also, about QRCs or whatever they were called in the system, and other different parties involved in workers' comp cases. So perhaps you could give us an explanation, Representative Davids or Ms. Anderson, as to why we are moving this out of Labor and Industry. It doesn't seem to make sense when it involves
you know, the 95 legislation exactly did what I said it was going to do. It's put people on welfare that got hurt at work. And I was guaranteed that that never would happen when that bill passed. And I have many constituents, as does Representative Anderson and Carlson and Solberg and everyone here at this table has been contacted with that's what happened. So I'm really puzzled right now as to what's going on.
Okay, remember, I should say, you know, I think a lot of this discussion relates to the A3 amendment, and I just want to apologize if I misspoke and led people to believe that it was a technical amendment. That had been my understanding. It sounds like it was more than that at this point. Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, to your point, I will defer to Representative Davids on this point, too, because I wasn't involved with the policy last year. As far as the base of the bill goes, I think that the thought was for efficiency and to beef up the fraud unit. That is why our workers' comp fraud folks are going over to Commerce. And the policy of that was done last year. And this bill is primarily the funding of it. And then a couple of other issues like the state of policy issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Anderson, could you get me, before this bill gets to the floor, I would like a list of, over the last 5 years, of who this investigative unit at Labor and Industry has investigated. Have they investigated insurance company like the original intent, or just injured workers? Have they investigated rehabilitation specialists and others in the system, as the bill was intended when it was written, as I remember, I was there at the table. So before this bill gets to the floor, I'd like that information. And then, to Representative Holberg's point, her and I, again, are, you know, thinking along the same lines. It's frightening at times to me, too, Representative Holberg. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that we're creating a whole new, you know, police system for investigating insurance fraud. And it seems with the money that we lack around here, there's never money for school kids. There's not money for nursing homes. There's not money for education for our children. But now all of a sudden there's money for an insurance, or for creating, I guess, what is it, Representative Earhart, to, you know, police cops for the insurance industry is basically what it is.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rukavina, to that point, we're not taking any money from education. We're not taking money from nursing homes or LGAs or anything like that. Bill, the insurance industry is funding this on their own. They're paying for it, and yes, the consumers will eventually pay. I think they'll actually eventually pay less, because I think they'll pick up enough of the bad folks that are because when there's insurance fraud and they're ripping somebody off, they're ripping everybody off, and they may get a couple hundred grand on an insurance fraud deal, but that costs everybody else some money. So we're not taking any money away from anybody on this. The companies have stepped forward and said, we'll pay for this, and I think that's a good way to go.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Is there anyone at this table that's seen their insurance, any kind of insurance policy go down recently? Raise your hand.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rukavina. Representative Davids.
It might still stay the same. It went up a little bit.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rukavina, this is insurance. We sell insurance for peace of mind. We never said it was going to cover anything.
Any other discussion to House File 2640 as amended? Representative Segrin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question about...
That was a good one.
The Commerce Department is now going to be establishing a chief law enforcement officer to head up this fraud investigative unit now. I mean, you've been doing some fraud investigation, I'm understanding. Now you're going to have a chief law enforcement officer in addition. So you're going, and that's going to be established through the fees that are charged to these insurance companies. And then as I understand it, the auto theft prevention thing is going to be moved to Commerce also, out of public safety. Are we creating two kind of public safety entities in our state with this? I mean, it sounds like we're moving into now we're going to have the auto theft prevention, which I think is a police function, a public safety function. I understand the argument about this coming out of insurance premiums, but I'm a little bit uncomfortable with what we're establishing here is two entities that are going to be
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Segrin, to answer the first question, yes, there'd be a chief law enforcement officer. They have to be post-board certified. That was a concern of some of the law enforcement folks, but they'd have to be post-board certified. And when we look at what we're doing here, I think it makes a lot of sense what we're actually doing here, and hopefully your comfort level can come up a bit. But we're putting insurance where insurance is. Commerce Department. Commerce Department regulates insurance. Let's get work comp over there. Insurance. The auto theft is insurance that's coming right off your comprehensive or the off your auto insurance bill. And so what we're doing is we're putting everything together where it belongs in the Commerce Department. That's my opinion. So some have said since there's a police officer involved, it should be over to public safety. But when it comes to your insurance bills for your auto theft, that's insurance, work comp, insurance. It's all insurance, and we kind of want to consolidate it into one agency, which is Commerce.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, and to the Assistant Commissioner, is there nobody within the department that investigates insurance fraud at all?
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we occasionally get referrals from an insurance company on a case they believe that an insured is defrauding them. But currently we don't have the authority that this bill represented 2 years ago. So the whole idea of this piece of legislation was to take the policy enacted 2 years ago and figure out a way to pay for it. Because our current investigators do the other thing. They take consumer complaints and look at whether or not the insurance company is obeying the law, and then and try and use our authority to balance that equation between the insured and the insurance company.
Representative Solberg.
Chairman, how many people do you have involved in that portion of the investigation right now within your department?
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's about 70 people that work in the Commerce Department in this division. Of that, about 10 of them do what we call a consumer response team, which is hopefully a quicker way to resolve consumer questions regarding insurance. And then about, I think, 25 of others do investigations that are more involved or elaborate and may result from referrals from the consumer response team. And then there are some that manage market conduct investigations of insurers that are bigger yet, sort of full-blown, trying to get at whether an insurance company has a systematic problem with how they deal with their customers.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm looking at is the full-time equivalencies of 11 new people into this division, and surely there must be some people that are doing it now. If they're not, then Commerce Department should at least, I would say, is not doing their job. And I don't know as if we're justifying 11 new positions where they have to be post-board certified. And we've always resisted having a state police force. And we're kind of going out of little pieces of a state police force. Certification or the qualifications for an investigator against the insurance company would not have to be post-board certified, I would think. And I'm just kind of strange that the other we're having that other qualification when you're talking against the consumer in this case. It just kind of seems a little strange.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Solberg, you can't put this function out to local police departments to investigate because it's a financial investigation most of the time. And these people have to be trained and skilled in analyzing financial records and things like that as they do their investigatory work. And, there are some data privacy issues that we've talked about that they'll be going into. So these aren't just, off the street type of police officers or detectives. They're more specialized, I think, and that's why We have to have them in the Commerce Department to do their job. So they do, you know, and again, I think in a court of law, having it done by a person who's post-certified helps us in court, just like any other police matter that's out there that, you know, they do the investigation, whether it's a drunk driving or a robbery or a theft or whatever you're talking about. But they're trained to investigate and to provide the details of the case, and that's what we're saying. These people are going to be specialized to provide the details of the case so it can be brought to proper prosecution. Right. So, you know, you have some valid concerns, but yet when you really look at what type of work these people are going to be doing, it is a totally different specialty that they're going to have to be working with.
Yeah. Well, Representative Solberg,
Chairman, and Smith. We don't have that same kind of a full support and concern about having to, in the law, having no mistakes when they go to the court when we're talking about the insurance company's wrongdoing. And I don't say we should put it on the local units of government. I would think that we would probably want to have people who are good in a couple of accounting degrees as opposed to certified by being able to carry a gun with a post port. I understand it's specialized training and investigative procedures, but at the same time, we don't have that same kind of standard qualification against when we're talking about the people who are investigating insurance companies in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. So the post board seems kind of an overkill. I would think that we would surely have accounting practices and insurance type practices instead of a post board.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Haas.
And Representative Solberg. When you look at corporate fraud, it's a totally different animal to investigate because you're dealing with personalities, but you're really dealing with the financial records of the corporation. You're getting information from the courts that are being ordered to turn over financial records, and that's where your CPA-type individuals who can analyze the information and other financial people involved. But this is dealing one-on-one generally with an individual, and I think that's where you need that post authority because that person is an authority figure in this situation. And I think it's what we're doing in this bill is proper. And, you know, the other thing is this legislature can monitor, and if it looks like it's, you know, they're overstepping their authority or something isn't working right, we can always change it. But I think we need to move forward because we do have fraud out there and it does cost policyholders money because you and I pay it in our premiums.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davids, in your bill under Article 2, there's language referencing auto theft prevention, and that I believe refers to the grants that are administered by the Auto Theft Prevention Board. Is that correct?
Representative Davids.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, yes, that's most of the grants are given out to Minneapolis, St. Paul, other local communities.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, those grants are competed for by various law enforcement agencies as well as counties, and I believe that money also goes, for example, to as grants to various counties, including Hennepin County, to pay for the time for county prosecutors in prosecuting auto theft, for example, within those jurisdictions. Heretofore, the Commissioner of Public Safety was in charge of administering the Auto Theft Prevention Board. And I note in the bill, it strikes the Commissioner of Public Safety and it inserts the Commissioner of Commerce. I didn't hear any of the testimony on any of the other policy committees, Commerce, GovOp, or Jobs and Economic. That was the position of the Commissioner of Public Safety relative to removing the oversight and overview of the Auto Theft Prevention Board from the DPS and transferring it over to Commerce. What does the Commissioner of DPS have to say about this?
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I haven't talked to the Commissioner of Public Safety, but from what I understand, and maybe Bob Johnson could come forth here to talk about this just a bit, but from what I understand, the Governor's office has signed off on these issues. I don't believe there's any problem there that I'm aware of.
Mr.
Representative Smith.
Representative Davids, the reason I'm asking is because the this line item has gone through the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee, for as long as I've been on it, and I was not aware, frankly, of this bill until now. So I haven't heard any testimony as to their position on transferring what I, on the face, and I believe are functions rightfully within the purview of the Department of Public Safety as opposed to Commerce. What, so what's their position on giving up this overview?
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, during the Commerce Committee hearing, I do not believe anybody from Public Safety had any opposition to this, but I'd like to, Mr. Johnson could add a few comments to this question.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Representative Smith, on your point, the Department of Public Safety did testify just last week over on the Senate Budget Committee hearing in response to the same question and described an interagency agreement and support that the agencies have either finalized or are in the process of finalizing, and they had no objections, I believe were the words of the administrator from the agency. I've met directly with the governor's office on this item. I was an original supporter of the auto theft program, one of the originators of the auto theft prevention program, and strongly support moving it into this fraud unit, which actually was in the bill that was passed 2 years ago that created the fraud unit within the Commerce Department, and then the bill amended after it started out in the process. So I believe it's fair to describe it as it's accepted within the executive branch and within the two commissioners, and an interagency agreement is either finalized or it's in the process of being finalized, and at that point supportive of the program change. If I can briefly, Mr. Chairman, just make two comments on that, that from our industry's perspective, this change is essential to keep a good program. I've met with the county attorneys, I've met with and been part of this process since the inception. Our industry is committed to having a good auto theft prevention program. The prosecutors that are there in Hennepin, Ramsey County, there's a multi-county grant being given. Our industry fully supports and expects that to stay as is and unchanged. So I don't believe there's going to be any change to that. The statute stays exactly as it is today. And as one of the original supporters of the auto theft program, we believe the better home for it is in a comprehensive insurance fraud fighting effort, which we don't have in Minnesota. If I can, Mr. Chairman, just for 30 seconds comment. This is a configuration that's found around the country. Insurance fraud is a significant consumer issue in this state and costs every family in the state a lot of money because people are stealing money out of these systems, auto, homeowners, disability, life. And so we don't have a coordinated, focused fraud prevention effort in Minnesota as some 42 states have. This is not an earth-shattering kind of a proposal. In fact, we're behind the curve on it. If I can, Mr. Chairman, if you turn to the back of the bill, maybe just one last piece of history to maybe provide some comfort, because I work directly with Chairman Davids and the Senate authors on this, which represent quite a spectrum of liberal to conservative co-authors in both the House and the Senate. That language, current law 45.0135, 2 years ago when it was passed, which creates this, was supported publicly by the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association, Attorney General Mike Hatch, the Minnesota Motorcycle Riders Association, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, our association, the three statewide agents associations, the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud. I'm describing, I believe, the Minnesota Chiropractors Association supported the adoption of 45.0135, which is the creation of a fraud unit within the Commerce Department. This is a broad-based issue. Consumers in Minnesota, and this is a number from former Attorney General Skip Humphrey, pay some $1,000 per year in higher premiums and costs because of insurance fraud. So for the price of a candy bar, Mr. Rickovina, if you translate this to assessment and what it actually would cost a consumer in this state for the price of a candy bar, maybe less than that, for a crime that's costing each family unit some $1,000 per year, we think it's worth an effort to gear up, and we need, this is criminal fraud. We don't have a focused insurance criminal fraud investigative effort, and we need it. Arson, disability fraud, life insurance fraud, this is real stuff. It's happening in Minnesota. It's costing us all money. And without a focused effort, we're simply not going to stay on top of this, and we need to do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to disagree with Mr. Johnson on one point. He said this was not earth-shattering legislation. In my campaign brochures, it was not only earth-shattering but groundbreaking.
All right. Representative Smith.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. You answered in part my question, and then you began to testify afterwards. That's fine. I think, Representative Davids, frankly, for the record, I intend to check with Commissioner Stanek and find out his position on transfer of the Auto Theft Prevention Board from his purview over to that of Commerce, because, as I say this, I've not seen or heard his testimony. And frankly, if it's a policy that he wants to adopt, I'll consider that testimony before the Chair of Judiciary Policy. But if there's some confusion or it is not as I'm hearing it now, I guess I will have to request that this bill be referred at some point to Judiciary Policy.
Representative Queasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, with the fee increase, there is going to be, you know, something passed on to the consumer, and it's some kind of increase in their what they pay for insurance. Have you done any estimates on what can be saved in insurance fraud by the insurance industry to help lower the cost of insurance, so I can at least go back to my consumers and say that we estimate maybe your policy will be going down by certain percentage with this being implemented? Give me some comfort here, or I'll vote against your bill.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Please, I wouldn't say necessarily the price will go down, but it won't go up as fast as it may have. And with that, I'll turn over to Mr. Johnson for any figures.
Mr. Chairman, please respond on the auto theft, because we got a track record with that program, and it's been around in the first 4 years. So it was passed in 96. It actually didn't get implemented until about a year later. In the first 4 years of its operation, auto thefts in Minnesota dropped 32%. Now, at least on that coverage, I can tell you, now, you know, there's many coverages, pieces to the policy, but it actually had a reduction impact on that part of the auto policy's cost. But it didn't offset medical inflation, car parts inflation, and repairing physical damage, liability insurance. But on those parts, there's no question that in those states that have comprehensive fraud efforts, it has a downward effect. I mean, a quantifiable downward effect on premiums, moderation, reduction. But again, there's so many the other factors of what insurance is paying for. They're not constant. They're going up. But there's no question about its positive impact on consumers. And we have a positive track record in Minnesota of the auto theft program successfully reducing the number of auto thefts.
Representative Queasley.
Well, we do a lot of prevention in government, thinking that we're going to save money, and we end up finding out that the prevention costs more than what we actually save. So I'll wait to the House floor to see what, how I'm going to really vote on this bill. So.
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Queasley, I'll look at you. You stick with me, okay?
On the House floor.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mr. Chair, members, and I always like to preface my remarks when Mr. Johnson's at the testifying table. He's one of my favorite insurance guys. He's a nice guy. But, you know, Mr. Johnson, I also get nervous when you're at the table helping write legislation to say how good it's going to be for our consumers. Now, you know, now we're actually forming an insurance gestapo, I guess it would be, under the state. And Mr. Johnson, I remember when Representative Klinzing had her bill in front of Chairman David's committee on the moldy homes and that whole tragedy that's going on in the building industry, I believe over in the eastern suburbs, you and your industry couldn't figure out a way to solve that problem. But now, you know, for the price of a candy bar, we're going to save all kinds of money, but we're really not going to save it because the theft part's going to go down on your insurance, but you're not going to be able to tell because everything else goes up. Well, you know, the $1,000 a year figure you can throw out there probably is like all figures when you use averages, Mr. Johnson, but, you know, there's a lot of our constituents with their homeowners and auto insurance certainly don't pay anywhere near that a year, and those are also figures you're throwing out for industries that's insured, including insurance companies. Again, I get back to the point where the only fraud being investigated in this bill is the consumers who supposedly are defrauding the insurance industry, but it's not the insurance industry defrauding the consumers that we're going to be investigating and sending police to your door about. So I have a real concern with this. I hope Representative Mary Liz Holberg sticks with me on this, and Representative Queasley and others, because I'm concerned. You know, when I see the CEO of United Healthcare getting a $94 million bonus yesterday, and wasn't it 94, Representative Abrams? What's it? Well, and that may be the case. That may be the case, Mr. Chair. But there's, you know, that could insure a lot of people in this state. I imagine it probably could probably cover the entire supplemental insurance for most of our Medicare constituents in this state. And to me, there seems to be some insurance fraud going on when these kind of bonuses can be given out to insurance executives, and it's a lot of insurance executives, Representative Abrams, that are getting these types of bonuses.
Well, Representative Davis,
I'm going to vote against this bill, Mr. Chair. I don't feel comfortable at all about it as it leaves this committee tonight, because what's good for the goose should be good for the gander, and if we're looking at fraud, we should look not just at the consumers but at the insurance companies themselves. I get nervous when the insurance industry is writing bills.
Okay, Representative Davis, I'm hearing some concern from members, and at the same time, I think this really is a very important bill. I mean, I think there is a real problem in the insurance industry that you've identified, and so I compliment you on bringing this bill forward. But I'm wondering if maybe it shouldn't go straight to the floor, and maybe we shouldn't send it to, say, judiciary first before it stops the floor. Representative Davids, I guess, would you like to either respond to that or to anything else that's been said by Representative Rukavina or others?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I can get by Rukavina, Holberg, Queasley, and Smith, I got a chat shot here, I guess. But I would like to go to the floor with this, and I would like Chairman Smith to check with the administration to, I believe they've signed off on this. And so I'd like to go to the floor, and then I'll make an agreement with the Chairman Smith that if Stanek has problems with this, or the commissioner, I should say, or any future commissioner, that it will go right to Judiciary Finance, and I'll go to the Rules Committee and try and make that work. But folks, think what we're doing here. The law is already in place. The law is already there. All we're doing is funding it. That's all we're doing. We had the discussion and the debate on the law itself several years ago. It's in statute that we're going to do this, that we should do this. Now we're trying to fund it. So I'm, you know, it's certainly up to the committee. It's not up to me, but I think we're spending way too much time on something that it's just a matter of funding and getting in place. That the industry signed off. I don't know of anybody that's against this, including the administration.
Representative
Rukavina.
Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, my good friend, I have not been here. I've not been around this place as long as some of the old timers, Mr. Speaker. and others, but it strikes me, you know, this is the first time I have seen the transfer from one agency of government to another, a function. Now, this Auto Theft Prevention Board has a function, and we have a spreadsheet, and we have fiscal analysts that have as part of their task the monitoring of the cash flow in and out of the Auto Theft Prevention Board. My point is, Mr. Chairman, unless it strikes me that if there's a that the method by which the DPS has transferred or okayed the transfer of one of its functions to the Department of Commerce, that's better answer that. that's
Stanek. Stanek.
If Commissioner,
if any commissioner wants to transfer or cooperate with the transfer of one function of their department to another one, they ought to notify the committees in the legislature. They ought to notify the legislature, because we have the task of monitoring the function of this, and to not do so strikes me as not appropriate. Now, I'm not out to kill your bill. It's got good points, but it also, I'd like to see a method established by which this does not happen again in my committee. And so therefore, I think it's a good thing for this bill to be re-referred. I'm requesting it, Mr. Chairman, and I'd ask Representative Davids to cooperate.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, one other point as well, and that is the administration might want to do something, but the ultimate decision comes down to the people sitting in that are elected representatives, the administration may want to do that, but it may not be approved by the legislature, and which has happened. I know when Rudy Perpich tried to do some transferring, we were in power and we said no, because it was what we felt through testimony or our elected positions that we wanted it where it was at. So I think that there is a compelling need to at least have the legislature involved in the transfer, not just have, commissioner's also got a governor. If the governor wants to transfer, was the commissioner going to say no? I mean, it puts him in a tough situation. We should have some hearings on it.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg put it quite well. I think if the only task that we do around the state capitol this legislature is, and that's a oversight and overview of the money that is sent here by the taxpayers. Enough said, Mr. Chairman. We can give you a hearing ASAP, the first part of next week. We'll cooperate to that extent.
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds like an offer I just can't seem to refuse.
Well, then, Representative Davids, I'll amend my motion that House File 2640, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would certainly, Mr. Johnson, trade a candy bar for a $1,000 reduction in my premiums, if that's what you were indicating. But then we are also not, there's no indication that our premiums would be reduced. But a question for the author, why are health maintenance organizations left out of the mandated assessment, which we're trying to stay away from mandates, and here we are mandating again?
Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman and Chairman Earhart, they're not regulated by Commerce or the Department of Health.
Well, Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Johnson, you also mentioned life insurance fraud. It seems to me you're either dead or you're not. What kind of fraud goes on here?
Mr. Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, actually, out of the World Trade Center disaster, there have been a significant number of forged death certificates and attempts to collect life insurance policy proceeds by people who are alive and are seeking their money, and it's sad, but we're talking about criminal acts. People are deliberately trying to steal money out of these systems, and it happens. It happens in disability, it happens in property, it happens in auto, it happens in virtually every line of insurance.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Earhart, this is a bill that would potentially save everybody that buys an insurance policy money, because the cost of fraud is billions of dollars every year for insurance companies. We had determined this direction several years ago, and I think the insurance companies want to view it as a mandate. They're gladly doing that because they're willing to pay for this, because it will show them rewards many times over. And I think it's time that this, the number one initiative from the Commerce Department, should be looked at under that vein, that this is going to save every one of us money, because it's going to stop some of the theft from insurance companies that's happening in Minnesota today.
Well,
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, that's all fine, and they should make a profit. But on the other hand, they ought to pass that through. Maybe we can put something in there. If they save $1,000 a year in claims or something other, they should pass it through to the policyholders. Otherwise, we're going to have a casualty company with another $94 million CEO.
All right. Well, this bill's going to have a chance to get some more of those questions asked about it, Representative Earhart. I'm sorry. Do you have another thing, Representative Gunther?
I was just going to tell Representative Earhart that we'll never know if policyholders will save money unless we can stop the billions of dollars of fraud that's happening in Minnesota. Billions, with a B.
The point, Representative Earhart, Chairman, is if there are billions and we're going to save billions, then we ought to save them also in the premium costs.
Well, members, I think this is a this is an important bill, and I think we've given it a lot of discussion. Unless someone else seems to feel like they've got to talk about it, I'll renew my motion that House File 2640, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary Finance. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, I think.
Representative Davids, you have another bill before us.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2044.
Chair moves House File 2044 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
And, Mr. Chairman, what we're doing is we're moving functions from one agency to another. and I'd really appreciate your support on it. I would like Mr. Edmund from the Tourism Division, if he could join me at the table here. House File 2044 actually does just what I said it did. It moves basically out of deed the Department of Tourism and allows them to do some things that they're not able to do now, and we'll be going through those. If I could introduce Mr. Edmund from the Department of Deed, the Tourism Division, to make a few comments about the bill and why we're moving functions from one agency to another.
Mr. Edmonds, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Edmond. I'm Director of the Minnesota Office of Tourism. I'll be relatively brief. What this bill does, very simply, it establishes a separate structure for the Minnesota Office of Tourism. This bill is revenue neutral. It doesn't impact any staff. There's no change in employees. It establishes a tourism council that is an industry group that helps advise and oversee the activities of the Office of Tourism. It allows for the ability to generate additional revenue through things such as gifts and endowments. This measure, we've talked to the tourism industry about it over the fall series of listening sessions. This has a wide support of the Minnesota tourism industry. We feel we need to do something to increase the awareness of tourism in Minnesota. This initiative also has the support of the governor and the commissioner of employment and economic development. And I also might want to add that through the legislative process, we've strengthened this bill. Originally, what we did is we just took our existing statutes and put it into this standalone bill with a few changes. But what we discovered is that some of those existing statutes and some areas dealing with promotional authority and the like, we needed to strengthen. So we did introduce amendments along the way that tightens up our laws. We actually met with the Department of Administration. We strengthened our competitive bidding oversight. We limited the use of promotion authority, established policies that must be approved by the Commissioner of Administration as well as the Commissioner on Employee Relations. And also, I think an amendment will be talked about here today to limit the establishment of a nonprofit board simply for the purpose of overseeing any gifts and to prevent transfer of state employees. Because the idea that the provision in the bill that says we can establish a nonprofit board is not intended to transfer any functions. It's just simply to have someone have a fiduciary responsibility for any gifts or endowments that were received to make sure that they were spent as they were intended. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be ready to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Davids, you do have one amendment, the A04-1320 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I'll move that amendment. Representative Davids, can you tell us about that amendment?
Okay, I'll defer that to Mr. Edmond. That he just described part of that.
20 years.
I'm sorry, A04-1329. Should have had my glasses on. Mr. Edmond.
Mr. Chairman, members, this amendment actually does two things. I was referring to one in that it makes sure that any duties or functions of the Office of Tourism or staff cannot be transferred to this nonprofit board, so we just wanted to make that very clear and include language in the bill to that effect. And the second thing it does, it deletes the section dealing with the mission statement of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I understand that there was some discussion about this previously. That is not, that's actually being taken care of separately, and indeed, housekeeping bill, it has really nothing to do with that, so we're suggesting that be taken out.
All right, discussion to the 1329 amendment. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the 1329 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The 1329 amendment is adopted. Representative Davids, other discussion to the bill? Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Davids, the part of the bill that establishes the 28-member advisory council, I know Representative Holberg said earlier, you know, we can't make a decision because there's 25 people here, and there are a lot of people who think large groups aren't very effective. But, you know, this looking at the Tourism Council sure does seem like a lot of people. I mean, it's people appointed by the governor. You've got the director of the Minnesota Tourism, 11 representatives of statewide associations, 4 tourism marketing areas, 6 representatives of different specified tourism businesses, which is laid out in the bill, some ex officio non-voting members, 2 legislators from each the House and the Senate, and then I notice there's language in the bill that says other persons, if any, as designated from time to time by the governor. Just seems huge. I guess maybe there's a really good reason for that, and maybe you can tell me, and I am supportive of your bill, if this is the exact same way it's been set up when it was the way it is currently, or, you know, what the thought is there.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lencheski, I think the key there, yes, it is a large board, and I'll have Mr. Edmund talk more about how they put that together throughout their meetings, but I think the key thing that will protect us on this is there are 4 legislators involved, 2 from each house, 1 from each of the largest political parties, so we should be okay.
Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we currently have what's informally called a Tourism Advisory Committee. It's actually 45 members. And we were looking to formalize that. So we actually had to cut it in half.
This would be a supplement.
What we tried to do with the Tourism Council is to make it as inclusive as possible, to represent all of the statewide groups, whether they be the Minnesota Association of Innkeepers, the Minnesota Resort Association, the Minnesota Bed and Breakfast Association, and we these are the core groups, the core people that are involved with our industry. This council really is to provide advice, assistance, ideas, and partnership with the Office of Tourism. It won't necessarily be approving budgets and marketing plans. It's really for advice. And so what we have found, in fact, with our 45-member council, that works well because we do have that involvement. This formalizes it, and we try to keep it as small as possible, but it's really difficult. Who do you leave off? And that was why we left it. We do feel that that will work.
Thank you.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up for Representative Davids on another issue in the bill is I noticed there's the duties laid out for the director, and again, I don't know what they currently are, but I'm looking at the new organization. And it asks on page 7 of the bill that one of the things that they'll do is generally gather, compile, and make available statistical information related to tourism. And I'm interested in that. I know a number of the people who are on this committee also serve on the tax committee, and we frequently get into sort of geographic debates, shall we say, rather than partisan debates about where certain sorts of dollars get spent and by whom, particularly within the tourism industry, and where lodging and hotel and motel and revenue and amusement, those kind of things are generated, and we frequently don't have very good information about that. I think this year the stadium proposal prompts us to ask a lot of questions about where these certain dollars are being created, who is actually spending them, and I'm wondering if you can tell me what kind of reports will actually come be generated out of this tourism board, and I guess I'd specifically like to request that we get some of that really very specific county-by-county targeted information, and it seems that the tourism, this new organization, might be able to provide us with that.
Mr. Edmund.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, the information that we're currently gathering is a lot of travel information about where people travel, what they do. We do conversion studies to determine the effectiveness of our marketing programs. We have some difficulty in getting it down to the county level, but the information we do have, we certainly could make that available to you. As to your point regarding the funding, one of the reasons actually that I really welcome this change to make tourism a separate entity is so that I can have more dialogue with the legislature about what we're doing. Last session, I believe we had one hearing in the House, none in the Senate. Hopefully, as a standalone entity, we can have some of this dialogue, provide you that kind of information that we just haven't had any forums to do so in the past. If there's something specific you're looking for, we can take a look at what you need and get it to you right now. But mostly what we gather and provide to the industry is information on economic impact, travel patterns, and the like.
Thank you.
Representative Seifert. Representative Riccovina.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Representative Davis, could you briefly explain in this one section where you're creating tourism police for investigating Iowa tourists?
We're on TV.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis.
It's already in law. We're just trying to fund it.
Other discussion of the bill? All in favor of House File 2044 as amended, being recommended to pass and referred to the General Register, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and Representative Quigley.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Next, we have House File 1703, Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a very large DE-2.
All right. I understand Representative Haas will move House File 1703 as recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think it's still going. I don't
know. Mr. Chair, we have an amendment, I believe.
We're trying to find that amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, while there...
Representative, I guess the amendment was not passed out. It's on the cart, so we'll get it passed out now. Representative Haas, I know it's a lengthy amendment. Maybe you can go ahead and start talking about it.
Mr. Chair, it's very...
Representative Haas moves the DE-2 amendment, I think it is.
Mr. Chair and members, this is the amendment that was put on the state government finance bill on the House floor. And so this is just making it in compliance. This is the agreed upon language that we had worked out when it left state government finance. The last time we said we had to have some changes made, and those changes were made, and we amended it then to state government finance. And we want to move this bill along and have it look the same on its own as it is in the state government finance bill.
All right. Representative Lippman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I think Chairman Haas has it right. It would be our hope that the election provisions that are contained in the DE-2, all of which have been passed by the House either this year or, well, certainly all of them this year, some of them last year, that we haven't been able to focus the Senate on, at least to convene a conference committee and to negotiate these matters. We have, since this very large amendment went on the state government finance bill, seen some positive movement from the Senate, and I think it would be better not only for the process, but also for the conferees of the state government finance bill, if this item were to travel separately. And so that's why we're opportuning on you today to delete all and collect all of the matters that we passed this year and last year into one omnibus election HAVA compliance bill and send it over to the Senate for action. Just briefly, Article 1 is the equipment bill, which passed as part of the state government finance bill and will allow the state of Minnesota to be ready for $38 million worth of federal funds, which will change and improve elections as we know it. Article 2 is House File 1006, which passed last year, and again...
Mr. Chair, can we save some time by interrupt?
Sure. Perhaps. Representative Solberg.
The Secretary of State and Representative Lippman and others have shared this amendment with the House minority members as well, Representative Hilty. And it's my understanding, except for a few technical changes, that it is correct, and I think that we're prepared to vote.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg.
I didn't want to listen to you.
Any other discussion to the DE2 amendment? Representative Kelleher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lippman, so let's just confirm that this is the same amendment that was shared with Representative Hilty. We understand there may be some concerns about the amendment still, but generally speaking, moving the amendment forward is probably the right way to move today.
Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelleher, it is the amendment that was shared with Representative Hilty. It has his approval. It is all of the items, save one small example, which Representative Hilty and other members of the minority have no objection, that has been passed by the House sometimes twice before, and we definitely think it's the best way to proceed three times before in some occasions, so as to engage the Senate in the most productive way and to save Representative Haas and his colleagues on the State Government Finance Conference Committee, whomever they might be, from 200 pages worth of election-related matters.
And please,
Mr. Representative Kelleher.
Instead of going through it all, could you just highlight that one item?
Certainly. If I could turn members' attention to page 67 of the DE2. One of the items that we forgot was a list of items under the Help America Vote Act of documentation that would be permissible to use when you send in your voter registration card.
And they just want a picture.
They wanted a picture. They wanted other documentation. Minnesota hasn't designated a list. What the Secretary's judgment was, and I think it was the right one, is to have the broadest, most inclusive list possible, the one that we use for same-day registration. So if you like the wide range of documents that are available to voters to use to prove whom they are and where they live on Election Day, you will love page 67, and it's the broadest list we have. We need to select one for compliance with the Federal Help America Vote Act. We pick the broadest and most inclusive.
Other discussion to the DE2 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Haas renews his motion that the DE2 amendment be adopted. All in favor of the DE2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now we have the bill as amended before us. Other discussion on the bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion.
Representative Haas renews his motion that House File 1703 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Lippman, I apologize for not wanting to listen to you.
I'm grateful for the interruption, Mr. Chairman. Representative Solberg.
I thought you set the criteria.
All right, we are just waiting a moment for Representative Abler, and then we will take up the last bill of the day.
I probably better apologize before I get a letter from the meeting again.
Representative Abler, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Chair will move that House File 2175 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Abler, there is one amendment. Would you like to take the amendment first or tell us about the bill?
Mr. Chair, it does complete the bill, so if we can take the amendment first, I would appreciate that.
Okay, the Chair will move the A-15 amendment. The Representative Abler, tell us about the A-15 amendment.
Just to make it, I've got a House researcher can do it probably better than me. It's just some technical changes to the content of the bill. Do you want to go through by lines or just kind of...
No, it's all technical.
Well, it's... Yeah, it's related to the policy. They're all little small details that the dentists care about and the podiatrists care about, and agreements with the MMA and podiatry, and it's very interesting, Mr. Chair.
I'm sure it is, Representative Abler.
But it involves no money. So.
Discussion to the amendment. Questions on the amendment? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At least briefly, Representative Abler, there were some concerns that the Medical Society had about the is that, are you telling me this amendment satisfies those concerns?
That's correct, Mr. Chair, and I don't even know if they're
Thank you.
They fully come to an agreement, and the question is, what could podiatrists do? And, they're here. Yeah, so they're nodding.
I see a head nodding.
Yeah, they're nodding. So the question is, what's the interface? And they got it worked out. So.
All right, Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, does this amendment take out the piece about the medical malpractice for dentists that's in the bill?
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Anna Benelli from House Research. This amendment, A15, does not address the malpractice for dentists.
All right. Other discussion to the A15 amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the A15 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So the bill is amended. Representative Abler, why don't you give us a brief review of the bill?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think there's 9 or 10 articles, and it has to do with really technical clarifications about the interfaces of different practices. Has to do with it's like each licensing board's housekeeping bill. And in some cases, it adjusts some fees, and that's why it got brought to here. It raises some fees and spends some fees, and I think the whole amount of it is $20,000 in and out, and I think the whole net loss of the bill is $3. If you want detail, I can provide you a section-by-section commentary. But otherwise, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Quisley.
If I just pay you $3 and get this bill out of here.
Hey, who, Representative Quisley? Representative Quisley, I know I can get more from you than that. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, just briefly, I did find a section. It's on page 57, the item 11 on line 22. It says failure to maintain malpractice insurance related to practice of dentistry. And it deals that the board can suspend or revoke licenses if Dennis fails to prove insurance. Where did that come from?
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Haas. That was all the dental stuff has been agreed to by both the associations and the board. And it came, the board felt it was an important thing that they would want to have malpractice coverage on the part of the dentist. And so in discussions with those two groups, they came up with this agreement.
Representative Haas.
And Representative Abler, in all the licensing that is done in this state, I am not aware of any other license requirement that we carry, anybody carry malpractice insurance or errors and omissions insurance or anything like that.
Representative
Abler.
I do have a witness to that point if you'd like, if you want to talk about that topic.
Who would, Doc? Could you give us your name and state your testimony for the record?
Sure, Mr. Chair. My name is Marshall Schrag. I'm the Executive Director of the State Board of Dentistry. And in response to the question with regard to the malpractice insurance, the genesis of that was based upon some experiences with our complaint committees where we experienced that there were cases where we had complaints filed. And the board has the authority to take action against an individual dentist's license, but not to allow recovery of costs to the individual who has been harmed. And in a number of cases that we addressed, that seemed to be a shortfalling for us because in order to protect the public, and in these cases where the public was harmed, we in fact did take action against the dentist, but the substandard care that had been provided to those individuals in the case where a dentist did not carry malpractice insurance, that individual was unable then to recover any costs in order to get their dental care retreated with another provider. and so we determined that would be something that would be beneficial to the state's dental patients.
Representative Abler, I guess I don't know a lot about this area, but is there a provision for someone if they want to self-insure and they have a certain level of assets or something like that?
The language doesn't specify anything except that they need to maintain malpractice insurance coverage. So if they were to demonstrate to the board that they self-insured at a level that that did cover them, there's no floor, there's no ceiling. It's the language strictly requires that they do carry malpractice insurance coverage.
Representative Quisley.
No.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you know, I have I'm licensed through a number of different carriers, and every one of my licenses that I obtain through those carriers require me to have errors in omission insurance or malpractice insurance. But the state and all my licenses I carry with the state does not require it. And that's why, you know, and a lot of dentists are insured through HMO provider contracts, and don't those provider contracts require the malpractice insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, in response to that, yes, that those dentists who do participate in large plans would have malpractice coverage. The dental industry is different than medical significantly in that most dentists do not have hospital privileges, and hospital privileges is where in this profession that malpractice insurance would be required as a part of credentialing. And so many dental providers are in fact independent business owners and solo practitioners, and may choose instead to participate or not participate in various insurance plans. So there isn't any across-the-board assurance that that any individual dentist would carry malpractice insurance coverage, although most do.
Representative Quisley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the witness, what is the percentage of dentists in the state now that carry malpractice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quisley, we actually have no way of knowing that because it's not anything that's required of our licensees to report to us at this point.
Representative Quisley.
Mr. Chair, to that point, not knowing, I know we have a hard time getting MA clients, dentists to accept them and so forth, and even in greater Minnesota, just finding dentists. I'm wondering if this throws up a barrier where some dentists will go out of business or something instead of taking or practicing dentistry, and I would make the situation worse. So I'm just wondering what the percentage is that carry malpractice. Will this add costs to the, you know, already what we're having trouble with dentistry in the state, especially for the poor people in the state that don't have the dental plans and so forth. So I'm just kind of cautious on that point.
Representative Haas.
Mr. Chair, I'll move oral amendment on page 57, line 22 and 23, strike the new language.
Representative Haas, Chair will support that motion. Representative Abler.
I think, members, you can do as you like in this, in this last policy committee. This was discussed in the subcommittee, and the association, which would, if there was a concern about this, would have said that they thought this would be an unconscionable decision to requirement. They agreed to it, and the dental association, you know, is very active here, and they have a lobbyist. I don't think he believes here today, but they were party to this language being agreed. I don't believe they were coerced. And so you can do as you wish. I don't have a vote in this committee, but I think that it's not a bad provision. I think that if it's another way to provide a little higher protection for the patient, and the association agrees that it's reasonable, then I think this committee should vote against the amendment.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, I have a low threshold of pain, and I will find out yes or no on this amendment next time I'm in the dentist chair whether it was a good move or not, right?
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask Representative Abler again, or the witness, what I heard you say is that dentists who participate in HMOs and in large plans have to carry malpractice insurance, but it's people who don't do that, and I thought I heard you say that it's folks who visit those dentists, so maybe they're either not covered by one of those plans, so they're going to the dentist independently. They don't have dental insurance, so they may be poor, or they may be folks, you know, like, you know, potentially my mother, who has been to the dentist 6 times in 6 weeks for an infection because she can't get it healed up. And so I had it had never occurred to me to ask my dentist if they carry malpractice insurance. I guess I thought that probably is some sort of standard procedure. And so I'm curious, I heard you say that people who've had claims against dentists and it's been found that the work was substandard, they have not been able to then collect on any sort of remediation against the dentist. Is that correct?
Mr. Schrag.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelleher, yes, that is correct.
So, Mr. Chair, the effect of this language, which no one opposed who is in this industry that we know of in terms of the associations, that they actually agreed on this language was to provide a higher level of consumer protection by putting this into the licensing, and now we're going to potentially take that safeguard away. I mean, that, Representative Haas, you may have a low threshold of pain, and I may as well, but I'm not really willing to let the consumer go unprotected if this has been an issue that's been found to be a problem in our state, and the associations actually agree that this is one way to solve the problem.
Representative,
Mr. Chair,
Weasley,
Representative Kelleher, I found out one thing about being up here. Sometimes the groups, I'm not saying that with the dentist, but a lot of times the average dentist back in my district, and not all Deep Rural, but they are not well represented in some of these factions. So you have to ask the questions, and we're not really finding out how many dentists do not carry malpractice now. If we had that information, it was 95%, then I wouldn't even probably question it. But if it's 75% and there's going to be 25% that are going to have to start carrying it, which will mean some people in my district will now have to pay more to get dentists or go to the dentist and get that's a big deal to me. And they might be very satisfied with what they're getting now. Malpractice insurance doesn't mean you get a better dentist.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Haas.
This is through the Board of Dentistry. How are they going to police this? Are they going to require every dentist in the state to mail in a copy of their malpractice insurance, and then we're going to have to build a database and that to make sure, and all the follow-up, and with people changing, you know, and companies change periodically, and people change carriers periodically, it is going to be a nightmare to try to keep up. And I think what, you know, and there are a lot of dentists that are covered under the network's policies out there. So, and I look at my dentist. You know, he does a lot of charity work, you know, and takes in people to do it. And, you know, I know he's a good, reputable dentist, and I assume he carries malpractice insurance. But I think the association or the board needs to do a better job of educating their people and to make sure that their people have it, and not say that we'll come by and revoke your license because you don't have it. And I think it's a little harsh what's going here. I don't disagree with people not having malpractice. I think it's part of business. That's why I carry it, because you have to. But it's protection. But there are some people in my industry who don't carry it. There's a few carriers out there that will allow an agent to sell without it, but not many anymore, because they're all getting pretty gun-shy of it. And I think that's where the contracting comes in through the networks, require that. And I don't really know of any real true independent dentist out there. Are there that many out there, sir?
Representative Abler.
Thank you. And generally, part of what just made this language acceptable to the association was there's no threshold on it. It's not $1 million, $3 million, which is what a group might have brought forward. That's what I'm required to have under my malpractice to be in certain HMOs. Yeah, but that you can have any product at all, and so it could be 100, 300, which is a common one. So that was part of the why this was agreed to. I think that it was a compromise that took it down to the no threshold standard. But I think the board might want to comment about how they would police this. I wanted to comment. I appreciate the interest in this bill. This has been such a beneath the radar bill. No one has cared about it at all, and so now we're here on a $3 net cost, which is what the bill loses. And talking about this thing, so there's more sections too we can discuss even more. I got all night. So
be careful, Representative Abler. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, we've already heard the testimony that people have been injured and could not collect because their dentists did not have malpractice insurance. And so The people have been harmed. I can't believe that malpractice insurance for dentists costs a lot of money. It's not like chiropractors.
Ouch.
There's nobody here to testify that this is going to be a large impediment to people staying in dentistry. So I don't know why we can't worry about just protecting the public, which is what this section of the bill is about.
Representative Carlson, I'm sorry I skipped over you before.
That's all right, Mr. Chairman. I way back when. In my history, I chaired a special committee on medical malpractice. And just listening to this discussion we had, virtually all the different providers in, and my recollection that was one of the lower cost areas was dental. And I picked up on the fact that the director, and I'm sorry I forgot your name, but
Marshall Schrag.
Holsterhead. Okay.
Schrag.
Schrag. Okay. At any rate, my question is, with there not being any basic requirement in terms of what the threshold is, how expensive would a policy be?
Mr. Schrag.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our experience in reviewing this and discussing this with the Dental Association is that the average policies for dentists are about $1,500 to $2,000 a year. We've supported that that amount by a recent statute that was passed requiring the boards of medicine, nursing, and dentistry to provide malpractice insurance coverage on request for volunteer or retired providers who are providing care in nonprofit settings. And so we've been working with the state's risk management department to look at that ourselves. So Representative Huntley is right. You're also right. The amount, although $1,500 is a lot of money to me, in the scope of things, it's a relatively low amount for the business.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, that gets close to what my question was. You said the average was $1,500 to $2,000, and I was really asking what the minimal policy would cost if you just got the least expensive, and I assume it would be some number less than the 1500 then. If the 1500 to 2000 is an average cost, I assume that many of them are buying more than minimal coverage. But the point is that it doesn't sound, in my view at least, like a prohibitive amount, and I happen to agree with the points that Representative Kelleher were making, that it does provide some minimal amount of protection to the consumer. And you did provide us with testimony that you did have situations where apparently the dentist, after providing less than adequate care, didn't have the insurance and apparently didn't have the resources to cover the cost of getting the corrections made. And from the standpoint of consumer protection, I guess I'm just arguing against the amendment that's before us, and would hope that people turn it down.
Well, Mr. Schrag, I'm just curious, the instances you cited, I mean, what were the size of the claims that were in question that the dentists were unable to pay? I assume it sounds like they were sued civilly in court, which they could be in a case like this, and apparently there was a judgment rendered that they couldn't pay. How large of a claim were we talking about?
Actually, in the cases that I'm familiar with, there were no civil cases that were brought. That one dentist in particular that we were involved with declared bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy, and so there were no resources. These individuals who brought claims or brought complaints to the board's attention were not seeking from the board specifically the costs, and so I'm sorry, but I'm not able to follow that through because I'm not aware. The case that to give a little bit more background about it though is that these were generally elderly people who had paid tens of thousands of dollars for implants, and those implants, the initial surgery was done, but there was no follow-up care provided. The implants subsequently failed, and those people were left tens of thousands of dollars out and also had to have those implants replaced.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I think I'll withdraw my amendment, but I think the Board of Dentistry has to look at this because if, you know, you're going to have to figure out how to police this. And, you know, there's going to be problems with people changing their malpractice insurance, and I agree we don't want to harm people. But the same thing, we don't want a good dentist put out of business because he switched carriers and all of a sudden you get a cancellation notice and you terminate his license and, you know, he's already changed and they don't have the new policy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, if I may just address my concern. The board does have a very comprehensive database, and the model that we had anticipated using for reporting insurance coverage was similar to what you do when you renew your license tabs, that you attest to the fact that you do carry insurance. In the event that there were a complaint filed or we had other reason to believe that somebody may have fraudulently indicated that, then we would follow up with them to provide the insurance policy.
And Mr. Schrag, one of my big concerns about it was that we have a shortage of dentists in the state. I hear all the time about how different individuals can't obtain dental care. We've been trying to get retired dentists to volunteer their time, come back and work, and access other dentists in that way. And I guess I don't want to see anything come forward that's going to discourage those people from providing those needed services. And I guess I would encourage you to make sure if this bill does pass that you deal with that situation and make sure this isn't an impediment toward making people decide that they just don't want to pay this additional $2,000 to essentially practice pro bono in their dentistry. Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually want to move on, and Representative Abler knows that speech-language pathology is an important area in my family's life. My daughter has been served by speech-language services since she was 3 years old and is actually at the point to graduate now from those services, which is a great success story. I just want to make sure that everything you're doing here today in terms of the assistant position is, it seems like you're providing a little more information and protection and licensure for those folks who are serving in the assistant level position and giving consumers a little more information about what's happening in terms of licensure there.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Kelleher. Exactly, and what happened was last year we licensed the speech-language pathologists, and in so doing, there was a gap in what their assistants were allowed to do. And this addressed that and creates a way to have the new graduates to fulfill duties that are consistent with that. And it's, I appreciate your interest.
Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had actually hoped that we would strike that section. I'll just leave it as what you were withdrawing your amendment. But I, in listening to the discussion, and this is one of those sections that wasn't discussed very much, but I'm a little concerned about the precedent of starting to get beyond sort of the safety and professional practices of boards and into the subject of malpractice coverage. Because I don't think there's any magic about malpractice. You could have a malpractice insurance package that might not be worth the paper that's written on. And you may also have a dentist who is well covered by assets and is perfectly capable of self-insuring. I'm not at all convinced that our boards ought to have that. I mean, it may be a good public policy. That's a different issue. Just like forcing people to have car insurance or something. But I don't know that I really am comfortable, and this is, I think, the first time I've seen, really, where we have a board who can use it as a method of actually deciding whether a license ought to be continued. I know Representative Haase withdrew it, but I guess I would just sort of serve notice that I find myself, after the discussion, a little nervous about that section being in here.
You want me to renew it?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
To that point, Representative Bradley, would you be more comfortable with something, adding language and or an equivalent self-insurance? I mean, just the equivalent, like we can work on some language, this will go to the floor. If that would be, I'm willing to do that, and I, you know.
Well, Mr.
Representative Bradley.
Of finding some language to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you're probably right previously to point out in this policy committee, which we are not, and that's a fair thing to point out. I think for the sake of here, I don't know that I can figure out a way to make it. I'm just not comfortable with this being in here, and I don't know that I really feel it's within the purview of our boards, who I think really have a professional safety kind of responsibility. this is a different kind of issue to me.
Representative Abler.
I appreciate the discussion about this, and it's fun to talk about the bill. I think that Mr. Chair and the members of this committee and members of the House, I think it's, and of the legislature, I think it's the board's duty to say, for us to tell the board what its duty is to do. And I think that we've been faced with a situation where, indeed, the lack of malpractice insurance did not allow someone to go forward and recoup their loss. And I think in what I've discovered in working with so many of these licensing boards and the professions is that Minnesota is proud of its high standard of professional care. We expect our licensed professionals to be professional and have a certain standard of elevated to a certain level that they may or may not deserve, but we expect that. And I think that if you think a certain individual has malpractice insurance and they do not, if the average person would think that, then that's something that we've discovered in this particular situation. If you would like, I will work on as this goes to the floor, not to delete the section, but to find some way to provide for an alternate self-insurance model. Just so we don't want to, if somebody is well established and if a person goes bankrupt and someone's out $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000, I think that's a harm we ought to protect the people from.
Representative Queasley.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Abler, to that point, I mean, there's a lot of businesses that are out there that go out of business and people are stuck with $20,000 to $40,000, and we don't require insurance for that. When you start mandating insurance company or coverage, you pretty much say to the insurance company you can charge whatever you want now. It does make the insurance company have a leverage on people because it's required. I'm not too sure that the automobile, you know, that you have to have insurance in automobile is a very good thing to point to that's been that successful because it was supposed to reduce our rates. And I don't know, Representative Rukavina left the room, but I don't know if you can ever point to the fact that ever did reduce car insurance in the state of Minnesota. In fact, now we got to carry for uninsured motorists when there's not supposed to be any uninsured motorists, and it's a big part of the insurance bill. And it really drives people in my district nuts, along with myself. Here's supposed to be a case where everybody's supposed to have insurance, and it isn't working. So I'm not exactly sure how this will work either.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, often this bill starts out very controversial. And you have fights between docs and nurses about who can do what, and between physicians and chiropractors about what each group can do, and between speech-language pathologists and some subsets of them, and they're hugely controversial, and they're all fighting there to protect their turf, and none of the providers like their boards. They always like to yell and scream at their boards, and Representative Abler has taken all the controversy, I thought, out of this bill. And it's not easy to do to get all these groups, various sections of this bill, to agree. And in this particular part of the bill, the dentists and the dental board has agreed.
Representative Kelleher.
Sorry, I just wanted to remind Representative, or tell Representative Haas, that I have 3 dental appointments in May.
So you're glad I withdrew it, right?
My pain threshold is at least as low as yours. And I also have a brother that's a dentist. And I'm not worried about what he's going to say to me.
Representative Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, or to the House research person, I thought we established earlier in this debate, and maybe people weren't completely tuned in at that point, but that self-insurance, we don't dictate what sort of malpractice insurance here, just that you must be insured for it, and that self-insurance actually would be appropriate in situations where people can do that. I believe I heard that earlier, and I just want to make sure that's what I heard, because I think that's contrary to what Representative Bradley is now saying.
But, Mr. Chair, to that point,
Representative Haas.
Representative Kelleher, if they're self-insured, if they declare bankruptcy, then
that doesn't mean anything.
So right. You'd have to have a letter of credit that's or a bond or something like that. So, I'm trying to toss around how we can make this sound work better, because there are situations where somebody may have an alternative that they want to do.
Okay.
That's
Well, Representative Keller, I guess I don't see that it covers self-insurance. It says failure to maintain malpractice insurance. I mean,
okay.
You either maintain malpractice insurance by presumably buying it from someone or you don't. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I don't know how long you're going to spend in this room tonight, but I'm having a good time being here. If you would, if it would please the committee, I think Representative Haas and Bradley and Kelleher and I can sit down and come up with a sentence that would modify this term and allow for a bona fide pot of money that would be a bond or some self-insured pool that would not be subject to a bankruptcy that would be at least be the first thing to protect this person. And that might get the, if that makes the committee comfortable, I can, I'm willing to, it's going to go to the floor next.
All right. Well, let's, unless someone else wants to offer another amendment, let's try to work that out as an amendment on the floor. Any other discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 2175 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Seeing no other business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.